Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This is the third in a three-part series focused on climate change and its consequences. It's also about the reasons we have for hope. When it comes to climate change, how do we address or avert the danger? Joining us to answer this question are two grassroots leaders. These next-generation leaders are May Bouvie, Executive Director at 350.org, and Nana Firman, Muslim Outreach Director at Green Faith. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of VMware and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
For the young people of the world, climate change is an issue that will affect their quality of life, in many places, their ability to make a living, in many places, the future existence of their countries. And yet it's a problem they did not create, a problem they have little direct power to control today, and yet it's a problem that will confront them in ever more frightening ways in the years to come. And May Bouvie, I can't think of a worse recipe for getting people in harness, getting people active. There must be some who just shrug their shoulders and say, well, what can I do?
Well, fortunately, so many young people haven't shrugged their shoulders, and I can understand why they would, but I think the climate crisis has been incredibly motivating for young people because it is so clear to see how we are going to be living on a planet very different from the one that our parents, grandparents, ancestors lived on. That's what drew me into the movement when I was a university student, and my friends and I were learning about climate change and also learning how it was connected to all the other injustices we were passionate about. So that's why we see so many young people who are running for office on a climate platform, who are at the front of mass marches like the one we saw last Saturday, and who are taking leadership in their communities all over the world.
What is the 350 of 350.org?
350 stands for the safe level of carbon in the atmosphere, measured in parts per million. And if that loses you right there because it's so wonky, let me tell you the other reason is that we're international. So we didn't want to pick a name that was in a particular language that wouldn't translate all over the world. We wanted to pick a number as a symbol. And what 350 does is it tells you right at the beginning, we've already done too much damage when it comes to climate change. We haven't been at 350 since the year I was born, 1984. And so it's a message in and of itself about the urgency with which we have to act.
350 as a reference point, what do you have an idea that people can actually get it back down there? We zoomed past 400. We are at higher levels of carbon than we've been in the recorded history of humankind. I mean, back when the planet was hot and there were no people and there were volcanoes belching all over the place. Yeah, we were over 350, but not during a time when life as we know it was easily supported.
Well, not on the course we're on, Ray, not with a climate denier in chief and a lot of governments around the world making decisions that would put more carbon in the atmosphere, not less. And there's absolutely a lot that can be done about that. And that's what we work on. We work all over the world to stop the expansion of fossil fuels and to hasten the transition to 100% renewable energy in a way that prioritizes communities and those most affected by climate change. But it's not going to be easy. And in October, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change will release a new report about what it would take to actually keep warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that's correlated with the 350 target. So we're eagerly anticipating that, but we know it's going to tell us something that we are aware of already, which is that the pace with which action is being taken is far too slow.
Nana Firman, I'm very interested in the fact that there is a faith-based approach to talking about these problems. Because in the United States, conservative Christians have been very, very hostile to the environmental movement. They say, Our lives are in God's hands. Human beings don't control the destiny of the planet. And I'm sure if you and I traveled to places in the Muslim world, we could probably find imams who would tell us something very similar.
We all faiths, as far as I know, we believe that this earth is sacred. And each of us have responsibility to live in a way that also supports and maintain this wonderful earth. In the Muslim tradition, our Prophet Muhammad said that God made this earth green and beautiful, and he appointed you as the stewards upon this earth. So if you look at the climate change, there is nothing that is worse than all the floods, all the storms, all the droughts, the wildfire here in California especially, that has damaged our green and beautiful earth.
And if you're listening to this program and wondering, man, why do they have a director for outreach directly to Muslims around the world? But if you think about it, Pakistan is drying out at the same time as Bangladesh is being devoured by monsoons and the rising waters of the Bay of Bengal and the Indian Ocean. Hungry Somalia is getting little or no rain year after year. Muslims are right on the front line of this problem all around the world. What would leadership look like? Are you going to ask the Saudis not to pump oil? Are you going to ask the Qataris not to extract more gas from the ground and burn it around the world? I mean, how do you do without that money that's made them some of the richest societies on the planet?
The conversation that we have is to bring this potential new technology on solar or wind energy that we know, like the Saudi or the Middle East, for example, the fossil fuel producing countries. The technology is available at this time. So we are asking them to take the commitment on the transformation, on the strategy that they are going to phase out from fossil fuel and have a plan to transform into 100% renewable energy. Because if they don't do that, the victims are going to be other Muslim nation as well. So then we put that condition on the table.
May Bouvi, along with being numerous and being right on the front lines of this problem, the Muslim world, for purposes of this conversation, is also very young. This is not a very promising world for young people to be starting families, to try to make a living, to try to sort of get going on their adult lives.
It's scary. There's no question about it. And what you're describing is part of why we see climate change connected to migration, connected to questions about human rights and about economic prosperity for people throughout the developing world who did not contribute to causing this problem in a great degree and are living with its worst impacts. And that's what we see all over the world. And we see it in this country as well, that within the United States, low-income communities, communities of color, are the ones next to the coal projects, the fracking wells, the pipelines, and are the ones who are on the front lines of impacts. And so this is a story about climate change impacting the poor, impacting people who have very little with which to respond. Having said that, there is a tremendous amount of organizing and resilience in these very same communities. This is a story about people rising up and doing everything that they can, but the risks are very big.
But a young person listening to this program, let's say 28, 29 years old, might say, look, I'm not a shareholder. I'm not a company director. What power, what influence does a young person really have?
Well, I can think of three things right off the bat that young people are doing and can do. And you know, I'm not making these up. I'm watching it happen before my very eyes. The first is young people as participants in our democracy and in democracies all over the world who vote about climate change, who see this as an issue fundamentally about their future, and they see it connected to other issues they care about justice and about economic justice as well. Another thing young people can do is they mobilize, and we see this over and over again. I remember the first time I went to a United Nations climate conference, I was still young enough to be in the youth delegation, and we wore T-shirts that said, "How old will you be in 2050? And the idea was to convey that the people negotiating were not going to see the worst effects of climate change. And we were trying to point out, do this for the next generation. Do this for your children and your grandchildren. Now, of course, that's changed. We are seeing these impacts in our lifetime. But that was an incredibly powerful action that pushes decision makers to take more political courage. And the third thing I would say is communication and storytelling. And young people are right now the masters of social media. A lot of the stories that are dominating news cycles, young people are helping consume that media and shape those stories. And that is another way that young people are not taking this crisis sitting down. But this is not this dynamic of giving up, what can I do? This is so serious. We've seen this in social movements throughout history. And if people give up, if people gave up over struggles for civil rights, for suffrage, for the right to vote, the right to live in a non-segregated society, where would we be today? So I think it's a similar situation with young people and the climate crisis. They see the risks, they're motivated, and when I talk to young people, I always start by saying, I would be incredibly frustrated if I were getting involved in this movement right now, and my hat is off to you for your commitment, given the political challenges we face.
Nana Firman, you're an Indonesian. It's an island of a chain of islands of a very large population. Thousands of those islands are small enough to actually be threatened with being inundated. Do Indonesians, do people in Malaysia, do people facing this actually think, yeah, the things I do can make a difference to what happens downstream?
Even though now I live in the United States, but I keep my connection to my sisters and brothers in Indonesia. And this is our issue, but climate change is a global issue, but we are impacted locally. And I think as Indonesians, we see ourselves as very crucial, taking crucial role as well as strategic. So last year, we started to have this campaign on trying to pilot 1,000 mosques using solar energy. So not just the imams, for example, talking about protecting the earth in the mosque from the pulpit, but also people and community started to see there is a solar panel in my mosque, and then they take a pride on it, and then we can use that as a mode of education to people. And I think like each individual can take their own actions. A lot of people told me that, oh, I'm just a one person. I cannot make a difference. But I said, flip it on another way. Even a small step that you do, multiply that into 1,000, million, 10 millions, 100 millions. And if you see that, it's like, you know, if like millions of people doing the same thing like you, isn't it going to make a difference? And people start to say, yes, that is, you know, like that is the scale. So that's the spirit that we want to bring to people, that they're not just one person, that we are on this boat together and we will work together to make a difference and we are supporting each other. So I think like I'm very hopeful. I think like because I'm from the faith communities, hope is the thing that the faith can offer to all this devastation that we are facing at this time.
I think one of the toughest parts of this conversation is to imagine what equity looks like. Nana is from a part of the world with tremendous aspirations. They want to live the way they see people in imported movies and television shows living. They want the good things when you open up the door of an apartment or a house to have the things that they see other people in the world having. And then they find, oh, well, now we're going to have a simplicity movement. Before you guys get rich, we got rich by getting being dirty for a century. But now that we're already rich, we're going to say, okay, now it's time for simplicity. That's a tough sell to the young people of the rest of the world, isn't it?
You're exactly right. And here I'd like to point out that one of the worst impacts of Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement is our commitment to the Green Climate Fund and a commitment to actually support the transition off of fossil fuels and supporting adaptation to climate change for countries in the global south. So that's just one example of many where we see these inequities play out. And I agree with you. Visualizing what this looks like requires a lot of imagination. And I think the people doing most of that imagination are the frontline communities, are the people who are trying to figure out what is a just transition, actually. If we recognize the severity of climate change, what does that mean in our community? What does that mean for the kind of jobs that are created? What does that mean for people who currently don't have a job and the only job available is building a pipeline? And trying to visualize that, there's examples right here in the Bay Area in Richmond, California, of people trying to live into this equitable future.
Nana Fearman, how do you talk about these things to the millions of youth in Cairo, in Kuala Lumpur, in Jakarta, in the southern islands of the Philippines? How do you say, well, now that the world has been filled up with carbon by France and Britain and Russia and the United States, now we're going to come to your parts of the world under threat and say, look, you're just not going to be able to live in that wasteful, dirty way that people lived 50 years ago or 60 years ago while they were getting rich.
Climate change is not just an economic issue or a political issue or even scientific issue, but it's also like a moral and ethical crisis. We need to put that on the table first, that we hear that climate change is moral issue or ethical issue. So then with the youth in the global south or in the developing world that being bombarded every day with pictures and, you know, like all these films, like trying to live like their peers in the northern or developed worlds, then we need to really sit together, like all the youth. Like I almost have these ideas that we can build this solidarity together, that we want the future to look different, not like what the former generation has been developing this world before, but we want as young generation to create our own future, that we want, like May said, equity. So the young people need to be on the table to talk about equity, what kind of equity they want.
The heart of this equity issue is the role of the fossil fuel industry. And people are not being given a choice about participating in their economy. The jobs on the table that are being offered are in this sector. The consumer choices for what to put in your automobile, for the most part, are limited to petrochemicals. And so we're caught in that dynamic where the fossil fuel industry is calling the shots and have so effectively made it seem to the public that they're the only game in town and we're stuck with them. And one of the most important things that has happened in the last few years has been that finally renewable energy is starting to take off in ways that no one predicted. And so in some places, we are starting to have a choice. And in some parts of the world, and particularly in the developing world, countries like Uganda, the cost of solar is cheaper than coal. And so we see this incredible proliferation of people who are connecting to the grid for the first time with clean energy. That is a way to visibilize equity right there. If you don't have electricity and you have it and you leapfrog over the entire fossil fuel era, and there are organizations like Sustainable Energy for All, Shine, which is a faith-based clean energy initiative that I'm a big fan of. And I find these projects incredibly inspiring. And that's what it's going to take to provide young people with the jobs of the future. But if we continue to let the fossil fuel industry control the debate, we're going to keep having this discussion. And thankfully, that's been one of the major focus areas of the climate movement in recent years, is really calling out the role of this industry that's pretending like we have no choice and that's lied about climate change for decades while making record profits. It's, I think, immoral, and that's why people are divesting, and it's pitting communities against one another when, in fact, we should be able to be participants in the economy of the future.
If you were born in, do some quick math, 1993, it is going to be a hotter world in many places in the world, a drier world. And some people are suggesting, no, let's not make huge investments trying to stop this from happening. It's coming. You're standing like a bowling pin in the bowling alley. The ball's coming. You're not going to get out of the way. What we should be spending money on, May, is instead adapting, making the world a little bit more resilient, trying to figure out how we're going to handle what's already in the system. So young people today, stop trying to stop global warming. You're not going to stop it. What you should be figuring out, because you're going to be living and running this world, is how to adapt to it. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's a bit of a false choice because we're talking about how bad it's going to get. And I think that there used to be a false choice. You either worked on making the problem less bad, so reducing emissions, reducing deforestation, or you worked on preparedness and adaptation, building seawalls and other ways. I've seen a shift since I got involved where people recognize both are required, that in fact it's still a guess about how much warming is going to occur, and we have the tools to control that, and that's why people are trying to do everything they can to keep fossil fuels in the ground, because the more we add, the higher the temperature gets and the more severe the impacts are. And of course, this is one of the most interesting and difficult things about the climate crisis, is that the impacts we're experiencing now are from combustion a long time ago, and the combustion happening now is going to impact generations to come. And I don't know a lot of issues that operate in that way, where the whole question about solving an immediate threat is changes, because there's clearly an immediate threat. We're seeing hurricanes, droughts, and wildfires, but we're also only seeing a portion of it. So that is why it continues to be important to stop the worst effects of climate change in the future. And I think, you know, when I talk to people who are involved in resilience projects, I was just meeting with a group of urban planners who are working on some of the plans for New York City and Rotterdam in the Netherlands about flooding and sea level rise. They're very clear that they see their work as very connected to the work we do. And they need us all to keep going to stop further growth in emissions, because they know they cannot build seawalls high enough for what some of the predictions have been. And just to share some of the numbers for people who may not know, we've already warmed the planet 1 degree Celsius. And we're seeing the impacts we're seeing now with just that level of warming. But there are estimates, if we continue business as usual, upwards of 4, 5, 6 degrees of warming. So if you, that's, I think, one of the most important facts about climate change to understand. And if we don't manage to keep fossil fuels in the ground and use land differently, we are on track for something quite catastrophic.
Sometimes people like looking at climate change probably in despair that what can I do? This is not going to change anything. But, you know, like if I could like refer to the teaching in Islam, the prophet said that even if tomorrow is the end of the world, if you have a seedling in your hand planted, people always think that, well, it's going to, the world is going to collapse. Why am I doing something like planting a tree? That is the hope that we planted on people, on the community, that yes, this looks chaotic, but we will find the solution and we can do it together.
So in order to move from thought to action, you have to push back on that hopelessness.
Yes, I love that quote, Nana. And I think about the activists who have fought, whose lives have been under threat, and who have fought so hard in movements for us to have the lives we have today. And so we stand on the shoulders of people who have confronted despair and kept going. And I draw inspiration from that. And I'm also a person of faith, and I think about this a little bit like the question of having faith. You cannot prove that having faith is making your life better. We cannot know exactly if our actions in this movement will add up to enough. There is no way of knowing, but it is still worth having the faith and doing the work because of how important it is for so many people's lives.
May Bouvi, great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Nana Fearman, a pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Join us at worldaffairs.org. In the second half of our show, Ray Suarez was in conversation with two activists. One was May Bouvi, executive director at 350.org, and the other was Nana Fearman, Muslim outreach director at Green Faith. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of VMware and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.